Welcome to Witch Hunt, the podcast covering past witch trials and the modern-day witch hunt crisis. I'm Josh Hutchinson.
And I'm Sarah Jack. It's March, Women's History Month. This week, on March 8th, it will be International Women's Day. The International Women's Day campaign's theme is Inspire Inclusion. Be sure to check for that hashtag, Inspire Inclusion, across social media to find women and organizations talking about inspiring inclusion. We are excited to have Dr. Samantha Spence back. Her expertise in law and gender equity profoundly ties into the theme of Inspire Inclusion, particularly relevant during Women's History Month and International Women's Day.
Her dedicated efforts to combat the discrimination and violence stemming from witchcraft accusations highlight a critical yet often overlooked issue affecting women's inclusion. By advocating for the rights of those unjustly targeted and emphasizing the importance of global solidarity, Dr. Spence embodies the International Women's Day campaign's call to action. Her work not only addresses specific instances of gender-based violence, but also champions the broader cause of gender equity, inspiring societal change and fostering a more inclusive world for women everywhere.
She emphasizes the grave issue of gender inequality perpetuated by these accusations, discusses the complexities of addressing violence against women, and highlights the importance of education and mentorship programs.
Additionally, she stresses the significance of female leadership in challenging harmful norms and promoting inclusivity.
Key points include the disproportionate impact on vulnerable women, the various barriers these women face, and the strategies proposed to combat these issues, such as legislative reform, awareness campaigns, and international cooperation. Thank you for coming back. Welcome, Dr. Spence.
So my name is Dr. Samantha Spence. I have a few different roles. So my day job is I'm a course director in law at Staffordshire University in the UK. I'm also the co-director for the Staffordshire University Violence Against Women and Girls Hub in the UK. I am the co-director for the International Network Against Accusations of Witchcraft and Associated Harmful Practices. I'm also a member of the International Alliance to End Witch Hunt, based in India, and I am the deputy chair of the National Working Group Forum on Abuse Linked to Spiritual Possession and Ritual Abuse. Yeah, a kind of roundabout mix of job titles there, but my main research focus is violence against women and girls related to harmful practices and predominantly witchcraft accusations.
Thank you, Dr. Spence. This year's International Women's Day theme is Inspire Inclusion and Take Action to Drive Gender Parity. And so I'm so excited to have your lens on this, addressing the harmful practices and accusations of witchcraft in light of this. How is witchcraft accusation violence a grave issue of gender inequality and exclusion?
It is a grave issue of gender inequality and exclusion for many reasons, but overall because it disproportionately affects women. And what it does is it perpetuates harmful stereotypes and discrimination based on gender. And it does it in a numerous way. So one of the ways is that it targets particularly vulnerable women. For witchcraft accusations, they are mainly elderly women or widows or those from marginalized communities who become the primary targets. And they use to scapegoat and target these women who are perceived as vulnerable, or who deviate from what the society pursues as normal. It's very much rooted in gender power dynamics. And within this narrative, women are perceived as inferior, powerless, and this is why they are more susceptible to these malevolent supernatural influences. What they do is they reinforce this patriarchy and they maintain control over men, control over women's behavior, autonomy, and social role. It's used as an exclusion tool, a stigmatization from their communities. There's violent intersectionality, which I think we'll come to later on, that it intersects with various other forms of oppression. And it impacts predominantly on women's rights, the fundamental rights to life, dignity, freedom from violence. And it undermines the efforts to advance gender equality, empowerment, and social justice because it's constantly perpetuating these harmful stereotypes and limiting women's agency in and participation in public life, it affects every single angle of women's lives, very much so.
How do accusations of witchcraft serve as barriers to women's inclusion?
Socially, they are socially excluded from communities if accused. So they can be shunned by neighbors, relatives, and their own families. And that leads to isolation and exclusion from society. And women are sometimes mostly left vulnerable and on their own. Not only that, they are marginalized economically as well, because they can lose their livelihood and communities will drive them out. And then they refuse to engage in any form of economic transaction out of fear of superstition. And this then drives this deeper cycle of poverty and deprivation. They lose the family. They lose the community support. They are subject to physical violence and harassment. They result in hindered access to healthcare and social services and can be denied medical treatment because they're stigmatized. And that status of being stigmatized, again, it exacerbates this vulnerability and perpetuates exclusion from mainstream society. And that leads into access to justice and legal protections as well, because once they're accused, this stigmatization can often perpetrate through every level of society. So people don't want to help them. Education and always the final other one, because again, they may be denied educational opportunities. And this stigma attached means that school, people just don't want to associate with people who have been accused of witchcraft through the stigma. So there's, again, multiple different barriers there, social, economic, legal, educational, that impact on this.
Those barriers that you discussed really highlight that this is a critical issue of gender inequality and exclusion. What are some of the main complexities of addressing violence and discrimination against these women who have been accused of witchcraft?
Yeah, so as I've said, they disproportionately impact women. So these accusations primarily target women, and they are primarily targeting the vulnerable and the marginalized in society. So what that does is it perpetuates inequality. It reinforces discriminatory norms and attitudes towards women. It's also systemic discrimination because they're rooted in deeply ingrained patriarchal beliefs and social structures. And these are the ones that prioritize male authority and control over women's lives. So accusations then will serve as a mechanism where it enforces conformity to these traditional gender roles, and it punishes women who dare to deviate from what is the expected in society. And again, violence, human rights violations, mostly women who are accused of witchcraft are subjected to various levels of violence, physical assault, torture, murder. And these are human rights violations, like dignity. Women should be able to live their lives free from any form of violence. And things that I've touched on, again, this social exclusion and marginalization that perpetuates these cycles of poverty and deprivation and social isolation. And the barriers, justice, education, healthcare, undermining gender equality, and again, intersectionality, which I know we're going to come to, is another issue there, because not only are they discriminated for being a woman, you then discriminated on so many different levels. It just causes so many issues there. It's just a vicious circle of oppression.
And how do witch hunts happening now affect the next generation of women?
They can be profound, they're multifaceted, and they affect the well-being, social relations, and again, access to resources. And I think for the next generation, some of the problems we'll have is that the psychological trauma where they're growing up in these societies where witch hunts occur will have long-lasting psychological effect. Witnessing the persecution, the violence, the ostracization faced by older women, might be their mother, their grandmother, it's going to have a massive effect on their mental health and well-being. And again, the stigma associated with witch hunts might then pass to the next generation of women, because the belief that it could be inherited. It causes rifts within families. So it puts the younger generation against the older generations, because whose side do you want to be on in this witchcraft battle? Do you want to side with the accusers, or do you side with the victims? If you side with the victim, you automatically become tainted with the same brush. again, economic instability. So you've got issues there that what do you do? Do you side with the accusers to help yourself? Or do you put yourself out there and risk losing everything to help the vulnerable? And I think it's just an inherited trauma and a cultural legacy that just perpetuates on and on. However, what I would like to say is that if we take all that into consideration, what we do have in the next generation of women is that many of them are advocates for change and social justice. And what we can do is we can turn this negativity around and they can then challenge these harmful beliefs and practices and promote intergenerational dialogue, maybe, and advocate for the rights of older women affected by witch hunt. But again, there's issues there and problems because you're asking people to put their own lives at risk here. So I understand that's difficult, but there are people doing this, and it's a powerful way to empower.
Considering your extensive experience with the UN and your work on harmful practices, what strategies do you find most effective in promoting inclusion and preventing violence against women accused of witchcraft?
As a lawyer, I have to say legislative reform and enforcement, but we all know we can strengthen legal frameworks and ensure that there's enforcement of law and criminalize harmful practices, but this does not work in isolation. What we need is a holistic approach, awareness raising and education. So the work that you're doing in the podcast and the awareness campaigns, educational programs that challenge these beliefs and stereotypes, people talking about this, but also targeting the community, religious leaders, policymakers, and other stakeholders. Let's get this conversation going. And engaging communities and empowering communities is key there, because the only way you can engage the local communities is by empowering the local actors and local women's organizations, grassroots leaders. But if you start to build these partnerships and foster this dialogue, then you can promote this kind of intersectional conversation. And if you're training and building capacity amongst the people in those communities, or the educators, or the healthcare providers, law enforcement official, you're trying to sensitize them to the needs and rights of these women affected, because they understand the issues. And I think a lot of it is that they don't understand the issues. Therefore, you don't know how to respond effectively to these issues. And two of the key ones here is international cooperation is key, because this isn't just an issue in one place. This is an issue everywhere. And this means that everybody has to join up and engage. So multilateral organizations, human rights mechanisms, they're for everyone, they're not just for the few. Civil society, get people talking, raise awareness and advocate for policy change at a national level, absolutely, but also at an international level. But one of the things that is missing is data collection and research. We all research into this area, but it has been raised again, and it was raised recently at the UN in Geneva when I was there, that there's an issue with data collection. And the problem with data collection is that, one, it's hidden. Two, people don't want to talk about it. And three, countries don't want to say, oh yeah, we've got a problem here with witchcraft accusations. Also, a lot of the time, it's not on the agenda. So there's problems there with how do we get this data collection if there's nothing in place to collect the data within these communities and within these countries? And that's powerful, because you need the data as the evidence to prove what you're saying is happening. And then you can get the policies and everything integrated into the mainstream. And it has a top-down, bottom-up approach, really, that we need to meet in the middle. And everybody has to work together. And that's the key.
And working together, how do we collectively forge a more inclusive world for women?
We need collective action. So from everyone, so commitment from individuals, from communities, governments is key, civil society, and also the private sector. And what we need to be doing is challenging these gender norms and stereotypes, because they perpetuate inequality, they perpetuate discrimination. So let's promote positive representation of women in the media, in education, in popular culture, and challenge these harmful stereotypes that are limiting women's role. Invest in education, equal access to education for men and women, boys and girls, is essential, because you're empowering women, you're expanding their economic opportunities, and you're enabling them to fully participate in society as leaders, as innovators and agents for change. but you're also educating men as well on women's roles in society. And that's something that is key. And strengthen the laws, make the laws equal, promote women's rights, address gender-based violence, and criminalize harmful practices. And another thing that's key is supporting health and well-being, because access to healthcare, including sexual and reproductive healthcare services, is vital for women's health and well-being. And in many places, there's barriers and stigmas attached that women don't receive this care. We need to promote this. And again, this comes back to this point of allyship with males, men. Engaging men and boys as advocates is key. And it's something I do. I work with a lot of men to have these conversations. Because what you do is you're challenging this toxic masculinity and promoting positive masculinity, but through the mouths of the people who are male. So as a woman, you're saying, okay, it becomes an attack on men, and that's not what it is. But when a man's saying it, it's very different. And you're then challenging these roles and the respect for women and fostering solidarity between men and women, not putting them against each other, which is quite common in this fight for women's rights.
Would broader recognition of harmful practices as common forms of gender-based violence yield substantial impact in inclusion efforts?
Yeah, it would. It needs to be recognized. Harmful practices per se need to be recognized. So heightened awareness of what the extent and the impact of these practices are. And that can then shed light on the systemic nature of gender-based violence and the comprehensive strategies to address it. And I know this very much so. You talk about witchcraft accusations and people have no idea, but if you showed someone a visible picture of a woman who had been tortured or murdered or beheaded, then that gives it a very different narrative. And policy attention as well, resources, governments need to prioritize funding and policy initiatives aimed at targeting these practices, legal frameworks, accountability, support for survivors, recognizing that harmful practices is an issue and empowering survivors to seek help and support as opposed to ostracizing them and blaming them for the abuse that they've suffered. Because what that does is if you empower them and give them support, it validates their experiences and it reduces the stigma and shame from communities, but also from themselves. And it increases awareness and access to services, so legal aid, counseling. And that, again, has this kind of cycle of preventing and education, because you can then start to think, okay, if we're recognizing harmful practices, then how can we get that out there? How can we raise the awareness through education? How can we then develop these targeted interventions? How can we change the attitudes that perpetuate these practices? How do we do that community level? How do we do it at national level? And then how do we do it at international level? But it's very much a collective approach here that we need.
And how critical are educational and mentorship programs in dismantling myths related to witchcraft?
They're vital. They're crucial. One of the key things is promotion of critical thinking, because what education does is it provides people with the knowledge and critical thinking skills are necessary to question and to challenge these myths and superstitions surrounding witchcraft. It gets people to ask, why? Why is that happening? What's the cause of that? And it promotes evidence-based reasoning and scientific inquiry. It helps to dispel misconceptions and it fosters a more rational understanding of essentially natural phenomena. Why has this happened? Oh, this has happened because of this and the evidence is here, as opposed to this has happened and then that woman's done it over there. Again, raising awareness is key here. But this countering of misinformation. So mentoring programs are key, led by these trusted members in community, the role models, to counter the misinformation that's coming through. Because then you can provide guidance and support, and then you provide the accurate information to those people to help them understand, actually, the cause of that wasn't that woman over there. It was this. It was illness. Empowerment. And resilience as well is equipping these people with the knowledge to counteract it themselves. Let's foster critical thinking, empathy, solidarity, help communities come together as opposed to trying to divide and conquer, which is very much what witchcraft does. And by doing that, you then foster this community dialogue and you get people talking. And long-term, these educational and mentorship programs can contribute to sustainable change because you're addressing the root cause. Until you address that root cause, it's just going to go on and on. So once you've addressed that and you've invested in education and get people to think about what's actually happening, what is the true cause of that, you can start to build a resistance to this witchcraft myth. It's not easy.
Can you explain the intersectionality of gender exclusion?
Intersectionality refers to an interconnected nature of different categorizations: race, class, gender, sexuality, ability, disability, ethnicity, and how all these together overlap and intersect. And what that does is it creates a unique experience of discrimination and of privilege and exclusion for different individuals or different groups. So when we're talking about intersectionality of gender exclusion, for example, what we're doing is we're acknowledging that it doesn't occur in isolation, but it exists in an intersect, sorry, in other forms of discrimination and marginalization. Different racial and ethnic backgrounds may experience different exclusion in barriers to education, healthcare, employment. Class in India, the caste system promotes inequality there. Sexuality, ability, disability, difference is the key there. Anything that's different to what society says is the norm is vulnerable. Age is another one. Children are victims of witchcraft accusations. Elderly women as well, because they've got no protection. And migration, refugees, minority groups are all faced. So you could be a woman, you could be a disabled woman, a disabled elderly woman from a marginalized group. And what that means is you've got these multiple layers and a lower caste. You've got all these multiple layers there that intersect with each other and just promote and perpetuate discrimination.
And how do cultural, economic, and social factors contribute to the accusations?
They shape the attitudes towards witchcraft because in many societies, it is that deeply ingrained. It passed down through generations, though, through cultural narratives, through folklore, religious teachings. And these can perpetuate these stereotypes about women and attributes these supernatural powers to certain individuals, so particularly women. And socioeconomic equality as well. So poverty, inequality fuel accusations of witchcraft. If someone is experiencing economic hardship and they want some money, they may scapegoat or blame individuals or land grab. And it's a form of social power. So it maintains these existing power dynamics and it maintains the inequalities within communities. And that leads to social conflict and tension. So interpersonal conflict, jealousy, rivalry, land, inheritance, marriage, anything there that is a way to exert control or seek revenge fills into this narrative here and marginalize and discriminate. And again, it's always disproportionately aimed at those with multiple layers of intersectionality of discrimination. And because generally these people are the ones that lack the access to social supports or legal protection. So again, they are particularly vulnerable in society. Education, lack of education, lack of legal system, weak legal systems, they don't help these people. Society's made for the top, let's just say. So the lower down you are in society, the less you have access to, and the more you are vulnerable in society, and that's completely unfair.
Could you tell us how intersectional action approaches can ensure that the diverse experiences of women accused of witchcraft are addressed?
Yeah, intersectionality approaches are crucial because what you're doing is you're ensuring that the diverse experiences of these women are addressed comprehensively. So you're taking into account factors such as age, economic status, and cultural background. And this involvement of recognizing that the unique needs and challenges that are faced by women who have been accused of witchcraft based on these intersecting identities means that then service providers or people, shelters, legal organizations, healthcare providers, they can then tailor support that they need and the specific needs of women. And again, this helps build into the empowerment and capacity building because you can tailor it to those particular groups and you can provide skills or economic empowerment or psychosocial support tailored at specific needs of these women who are affected. And I think that's key there all the way through, is that you need to ensure that the diverse experiences of women are addressed holistically, because these factors shape their lives and their identities and in very different ways. So we have to promote inclusivity and social justice for everybody, but in a way that benefits these women.
And one of the things that the women are in need of is mental health care and rehabilitation. How can communities ensure that rehabilitation processes for women who've been accused of witchcraft would move them towards inclusion in the community?
Facilitating rehabilitation processes for women is crucial, because what that does is it reintegrates them into their community and it promotes inclusion as opposed to exclusion and removing them from those communities where they feel safe. And what communities need to do is engage in the open and honest conversations about the harms of witchcraft accusations and the importance of supporting survivors. And by doing these awareness raising campaigns and education that dispels the myth and challenges the stigma attached, that can then have the effect of fostering empathy and understanding towards the accused, as opposed to perpetuating the stigma. But as you say, mental health is key, and providing that support there to women who have been accused and have lived through trauma is vital. And counselling, peer support group, other women who have been accused as well, talking about their experiences, it can help the women to process their experiences, but also to rebuild their self-esteem and develop coping strategies and empower them. Healthcare. Healthcare is needed. The access to mental health and support is crucial, and not always there, because mental health, again, is another thing that's viewed as unimportant or not always true. You can't see it. So mental health is very much aligned within this witchcraft mentality. If someone's suffering from mental health, they're possessed. And again, education there. Get health providers out there to explain and offer guidance and support their physical, but also their emotional and their mental needs there. Empowerment, provide them. Provide them the tools, let's just say, to get financial independence. So it's not just giving money to people, providing them with the tools to be able to be sustainable. And that means if they're sustainable, they can have a stable lifehood, and it builds up the self-esteem in women. But reintegration is key here, because what you want to do is you want to get women back into the community. And that's hard, because if a community has accused you and has violated you of something that you haven't done, then you've got to build back that trust. And what you need there is a long-term support and follow-up from people working on the ground to facilitate that. That can't be done in isolation. But again, I come back to the key here, which is addressing the root cause, because if you don't address the root cause, it just carries on and on. So these conversations, challenging, are key there for all these issues we have.
You have said that the law doesn't work in isolation. In your experience working with different cultures and legal systems, how do the responses to witchcraft accusations vary, and what lessons can be learned from these differences in addressing gender-based violence globally?
They vary significantly. It depends on the cultural beliefs, the legal system, the historical context, the social norm. Now, there are some countries that actually specifically have laws that address accusations of witchcraft. India, for example, has anti-superstitions laws. Not everywhere, not unified in certain states. Do they work? Not necessarily, but they are there. And being there in itself is a step, because what you can do is you can build on that and you can establish the clear framework from this legislation and try and enforce some kind of justice for victims. Again, community responses are very different there, depending on what the community is and where the women are from. And building these partnerships and learning to engage again with them in their own terms, let's just say, and recognizing and respecting cultural diversity is key, because cultural diversity is actually, it's diverse, isn't it? And you need to be contextually appropriate and contextually sensitive to local beliefs and practices, because we're not challenging belief. that is impossible to challenge. It's subjective. What you're challenging is the harm emanating from the belief that has happened and promoting human rights. And it's a very sensitive topic area there. So you've got to tread a fine line. Many times you will get the resistance to say you're challenging our culture. That's not what it is. It's challenging the harm. So again, it's always twisted to a way that suits. But international cooperation is key there because you're developing initiatives, best practice, crucial role of raising awareness, mobilizing resources and advocating for change. One of the best examples so far has got to be the Pan-African Parliament, who enacted the guidelines for parliamentarians on this, which is in line with the UN resolution. And what that shows is they're vested in this. They want to make a change. And I think that's one of the key issues there is that if you can see, okay, we're starting off, we're making some kind of change, but we want to promote change as opposed to completely ignoring the issue. And I think that the Pan-African Parliament is a fantastic example of someone who has taken this and backed the resolution and wants to make a change. And that isn't seen across the world.
I saw in the news today a community that had 8 deaths of accused witches and 20 more hospitalized from a poisoning event to determine who had caused the death of some children. And I saw in that article that the local leadership said this has to stop. This keeps happening. This has to stop. When you have somebody at the local level like that, where's the first place for them to reach out?
Again, I suppose that depends on the context we have. And I know we've spoken about Dr. Dinesh Mishra before in India and the work he does there and the awareness raising. But this is the problem of where do you go when you want to talk about this topic? Because it's not a popular topic. People don't want to discuss it. Government in the UK, we know the agenda, it changes. So if it's not on the agenda currently, then people, we're talking about this at the minute. It seems that we can't fit with all these different agendas that are happening. One has to take priority. And we are in a country, a world that's going through many wars, and the priority is there. So as they would say, issues like this, they're not important. And I think that's the problem there, is trying to raise the importance, because there's so many. This is just one. Violence against women is everywhere in so many different forms. And we've been going on about this for so many years, and we're still talking about it. And this is the issue there, that we need these people, local leaders, but we need everybody to join in and get on this campaign and say, look, it's not okay. But what you always get is you're always going to get people that go, oh, we're going to have a different narrative. And you get the toxic masculinity, and you get this other narrative that you see. Social media is a problem for this, because for everybody that's trying to advocate for change, you've got someone who is advocating for negativity and the constant battles. So it's really hard to challenge, but I think little steps, and if everybody keeps talking and going, then I'd love to say that in 20 years, this wouldn't be the case, but I know that won't be true. But people will know more about it. We'll be talking more about it, and we'll be educating, hopefully educating the next generation. And I think that's the key there, is getting into schools, talking to children and making them think, actually, is this a society you want to live in? Do you want to continue and perpetuate this cycle of abuse? Or do you want to change that narrative? And advocates for change and promotion of positivity and human rights is key there. But like I say, you're always going to get the promoters and defenders of culture. And that is a problem. And it becomes very hard to challenge, because at the very root of the argument is that you're challenging their religion and their culture. And that's not what it is. You're challenging the harm. And these become very difficult battles to have. And also the people that are talking about it are the ones that are putting themselves on a pedestal to be brought down. And people don't want to do that. People don't want to put themselves on that pedestal to be trolled or to be put down. Again, it's difficult.
Following the adoption of the resolution on the elimination of harmful practices related to accusations of witchcraft by the UN Human Rights Council, what changes do you expect in international or local policies, and what challenges will remain?
I think some of the changes would be that there is an increased awareness now of what this issue is at the UN level, but also at state level. So the Pan-African Parliament, for example, in the UK, we have the National Working Group. There's cases there and people are becoming more aware. And from that, you get policy reforms. Again, the Pan-African Parliament guidelines are there. And you can enact new legislation, strengthen the law that's already there. But also, one of the challenges, I think, is data collection and research, because this is hard to find. And if you're relying on people, you're relying on governments to give you information that sometimes they don't want to give, the implementation gap is another problem. So you can have the laws there, but they need to be implemented. And lack of political will is massive to not do that. Resources, constraints there that can hinder. Oh, we've not got enough money to... We've got the law here, but what do you do with it? We can't implement it. We've not got the resources to govern this, to police this. The infrastructure, we haven't got it there. Stigma, discrimination, and the cultural sensitivity are probably the hardest ones there, because you are navigating this complex myriad of belief, tradition, practices, and they need to be culturally sensitive. But balancing that with the need to challenge these harmful norms and practices that are perpetuated by these cultures that you're trying to be sensitive to. So it becomes a very difficult challenge, because not only that, you're working in diverse cultural contexts. So you have to understand the context you're working in order to try and have these conversations. And I think that is the hardest part there, because not only that, these conversations, you've then got to overcome the stigma and the discrimination that comes from that. And you know yourself, if things are indoctrinated into your brain, they take a very long time to change. And people have been brought up that way. They don't know anything different. What's for me to say that's wrong? And this is a problem here. But if we can just maintain this, these conversations, this awareness, little pockets, a little, doesn't have to be everybody doing it 100 miles an hour, just one step from a few people can change, and then you just take it forward, try and get the impetus going there and try and overcome some of the key challenges, raise awareness, get the information there, because then that bolsters, you've got the evidence, we've got the evidence, we can take it to government and say, we've got the evidence here. What does that do? Let's initiate a policy from that. What does the policy do? Could we implement this into law? How do we do that? And if we can keep that cycle going, and we can, we've seen it, say the example of the Pan-African Parliament, it just needs to have that political will and that agenda for change. And that's not always there.
How important is the inclusion of female leadership in combating myths and violence associated with witchcraft accusations?
Again, I think this is key here, because the representation, the visibility, and female leaders will bring the visibility of the issue and amplify the voices of the survivors. And the mere presence of a woman in a leadership role sends a powerful message that actually they can do this, and that gender-based violence needs to be addressed. It empowers other women. If women see other women on the TV, role models it, I want to be like that. I can be like that. And it empowers them to then speak out against injustice and demand accountability. It becomes a domino effect. And the community engagement, women together, communities, the ones that have the first-hand knowledge of how the communities work, the women going back to those communities and saying, look, I've escaped this. We can do this. You can change. This isn't the way it has to be. It also brings this dimension of gender sensitivity to address the witchcraft accusations, so that women understand. And this, again, is not the exclusion of men, but it's the understanding that as a woman, you've got a shared understanding of the forms of violence and discrimination that you face. And understanding that and empowering the experiences of survivors to ensure that they are actually believed is vital, believed and supported, because a lot of the time these women aren't believed and they're not supported. And that is a key problem there. And what you're doing there is you're fostering this solidarity and collective action of women and girls. As I said previously, if you get victims, survivors in a room and they're talking about their experiences and then they're empowered to talk about it more so. It's safety in numbers. People feel more confident and then others will start to talk. You see this on them. I was watching a television program last night and it was about people reporting abuse. And one person stepped forward, and then another step forward, and then another step forward. And that's what it needs. And it that actually, they've done it, I'll be believed, because otherwise you're putting yourself out there and people go, no, that didn't happen. But this collective enforcement and positivity of women coming together can make that change. And having women in leadership just shows that actually this can be done. This isn't impossible to those people that are being told constantly that it is impossible.
And it sounds like that first role of leadership could just be a woman being willing to talk about her experience to others who need to get strength from her. And then together they rise up the conversation and more leaders go up through there.
Yeah, very much. And I think you see that in all situations, whether it's race, it's gender, it's disability, disempowerment. People empower other people and you don't feel that you're on your own there and you feel supported. And when you have that support around you and that belief, actually, people believe me, it empowers them to tell their story and it empowers other people to tell their story as well. And that is so inspiring and it's so important there. And we spend so much time in the world, in society, cutting everybody down in negativity and promoting this positivity and actually saying, actually, this is okay. Let's talk about this. Let's get this in the open. Let's support these people. As opposed to saying, who believes that? We weren't there. We don't believe that. It's a mentality. It's a mentality shift. And that goes across the whole addressing any kind of bias, structural bias, inequality, systemic bias, anything there. Because again, you've got this narrative of people that promote inclusion and positivity, but there's also that pocket there that wants to put that right back down because that doesn't protect their status quo. And you've always got this embattled, but yeah, definitely power.
And we can see a lot of this negative behavior trying to protect the status quo in men. When women are in leadership roles, men often call them witches and seek to tear them down, and men need to stop doing that.
Yeah, very much. And it's why I promote you can't change violence against women without having men on board. And this promotion of men as allies is really important, because when you've got men saying, actually, I don't ascribe to this, this is not okay, then it might take another young boy to go, actually, I agree with that. Because what, again, you've got there is the promotion of masculinity. And at a certain age, boys and everybody really, you're finding your way in the world. And it doesn't take much for social media to penetrate with the negative. And if we can penetrate with the positive and say, actually, this is the way it should be, as opposed to completely perpetuating this toxic masculinity and these dangerous narratives, we can start to change that. But of course, the dangerous narratives are the ones that keep these people in power. That's how power works, divide and conquer. And we're always going to have that. But collectively, we can start to have these conversations. And it's not a magic bullet. It's not going to happen overnight, but little changes. And we've seen that through the decades. We've not got to where we need to be, but we've seen change happen. So let's remain positive and let's just keep promoting and talking about it.
Do you wanted to talk about implementing the UN resolution?
So the UN resolution was the thing that everybody was working toward. Let's get this resolution. And again, as lawyers, we know we get the laws in place and we go, oh, what now? And it's not legally binding. That's how there's no international police force. There's no international kind of thing that says, oh, you must do this. It's political will. And you can only enforce this by people being on board with it. So after the resolution was implemented, it was, right, okay, what do we do now? We need to raise awareness of the resolution because people didn't know about it. Why would they? Unless you're in this field. So you raise awareness of that. And then what you do then is you try to get that implemented within these countries, get countries to sign up to it, get it implemented. And that's what the Pan-African Parliament have done with the guidelines there. They've said, okay, we've got this resolution. Let's look at this. Let's take these guidelines and bring these into our arena. And that's what we need to do. And the conversations and the awareness raising, but as I say, it's a bottom-up, top-down approach. So you've got to have people at very grassroots level working up for change, but also at this top-down level, and they meet somewhere in the middle. I think one of the key things is nationally, if we can work, and this is what we're doing with the National Working Group in the UK, is to work towards national action plans. Because what they do is they say, we've got a problem here. How can we work together as a country to solve this problem holistically? So not just one set of people, everybody involved, the healthcare, social workers, police, government, legislators, communities, education. We all work together. How do we do that? How do we use this resolution, which is there as a kind of blueprint to follow? How do we then enact that within our own country or our own community and build on that? And again, from the bottom up, what you're doing is you're engaging with communities. How best do we get into these communities through education, through schools, through community projects? And you translate that best practice and you take it to other places and see how it works. Every country works very differently. And there's different levels of money, education. So you've got to represent this within each state as it would work. Within the rural communities, there's no point going giving a presentation because it wouldn't have any impact whatsoever. So how do we address that? What initiatives can we use that would be understood within those communities and fostered within those communities? Photographs, film, non-verbal films as well, showing pictures, because again, you've got so many languages there, something that can translate across all cultures and all languages is film, is photographs. And these kind of things there are vital to get the message across. And we have, as academics, we have conferences, we talk about it, but a lot of the time it's the action. And you've got to go and work with these people on the ground. And okay, we're talking about it. What are you doing about it? What's actually happening? And that's the kind of translation there from the academic conference to the realities on the ground and working with these people. And I have a lot of respect, like I say, for Dinesh Mishra, who are tirelessly going out and working on the ground and dealing with these cases without financial support from the government. That's what's key there. It's everybody working together. But for academics and for societies and educational societies, let's just say, then these conversations and conferences work. That wouldn't work in rural India. You've got to change the initiative. How do you do that? A forum theatre, acting these things out on the stage and promoting. But all these different initiatives there, I think, are ways to try and get this across. But again, there's so much resistance there that it's difficult. We need change, but it's not going to happen overnight. But if we keep talking about it and we get more people involved in the conversations and people with challenging agendas, we're always quite happy for a debate because people aren't going to agree. There's many people I know, the podcast will go out and people will very much disagree with what I'm saying. That's absolutely fine. But let's talk about this. Try and find a middle. Like I say, we're not challenging belief. We're not challenging religion. We're looking at people's lives and the harm that's caused there. And let's stop making these excuses about dealing with that. Let's look at the root causes of this and try and address how we overcome this. And let's look at women as women, as people, as equal, not as secondary. I think that's probably the key takeaway there is we are all equal. And let's just remember that.
Thank you, Dr. Spence. And now I will ask the women of Witch Hunt their feelings about International Women's Day and the discussion we've just had about the intersectionality of vulnerability and witchcraft accusations. What does International Women's Day mean to you, and why do you think it's important?
I like it because it draws attention to how a woman is not just one thing. It makes us look past what we see, how we see ourselves as a woman, and what is that experience like for somebody in a different community. We're like looking at it from a global standpoint. I think that's really important.
I look at it as what I can achieve, what I haven't achieved yet in my life, what's possible for me, and what's possible for all the people in my community. One thing that Dr. Spence said was that it's inclusive, but it also includes education of the men as well, so that we're not just talking about women being empowered, but men being empowered as well to understand their actions and how we can challenge their way of thinking so that they can grow right along with us.
That's a good point that you brought up that she had spoken to about how men are absolutely necessary to ever have inclusion. Men have to be involved because men are the ones that are doing the excluding of women from different things. She talked a lot about sensitization.
When you're talking about that, and then I think back to, again, that conversation with Neelish when he talked about girls aren't raised to have the same goals that men can have, the freedom of profession.
The education starts at the very base so that in teaching both boys and girls at a young age that it's okay to aspire to the same professions, the same aspirations for their lives, and to be supportive of one another rather than to oppress one another.
After you listened to the episode, what was your initial reaction to the discussion about witchcraft accusations and their impact on women? Were there any aspects that surprised or moved you?
I just think it continues to be a surprise on what an impact influence it is on women. In general, we still keep finding ourselves surprised. And it was clear from the conversation with Dr. Spence that it's not like this sideline issue that, oh, there's some oppression over here and some abuse and violence. Maybe we'll find some witchcraft. It's weaved into the violence women are experiencing across the world. There's violence outside of that, but it's clear what a big deal it is.
It is very clear. And for me, what these women are experiencing really shatters their core being. Because as I was reflecting on what I'm going to say regarding this topic, I can't imagine a woman being accused of doing something she didn't do, being an outcast from her family, her community, where she's suffering from economic resources. She's going hungry. She's just left by the wayside. And what that does to a person, I can't even imagine. And that I would suppose that will go also for the men who are accused of these harmful practices that they don't actually perform. But just I can't even imagine not having my family, not having my back, or my family tossing me out to the curb so that I have to fend for myself. And I try to put myself in these women's situations. So when Neelish and Dr. Spence are talking about rehabilitation and have to rehabilitate the entire woman, and I believe even when Peter Minter Amadou says that the women need to be fed first and they need to have some type of health care first, then that, and then everything else can stem from all of that so they can be rehabilitated and they can find support and find friendships and find the love of other women who have suffered the same fate that they have suffered, and just to look for them for support, aspiration, and think, well, you know, she's going through it and she's a little bit further along in her healing. I can do the same thing. So I just think those groups and that whole support system is so important.
Accusations of witchcraft are so damaging to families and the people that are supposed to be there for you. It's what happens in cults that separate families. These witchcraft accusations are breaking up families. There's not room for witchcraft accusations in families.
How do witchcraft accusations serve as a form of gender-based violence?
I guess I would say that according again to Neela Singh in his research and his work with the woman, that 97% of the allegations are against women.
When you're looking at somebody who has no standing and they are helpless and their whole self is harmed, and it's a high percentage of women that are experiencing that due to witchcraft accusations.
Yes.
Mary was talking about the boys and girls both learning at an early age about everybody being able to aspire to the same dreams. So that's part of the education, and part is when you're talking to, say, a group of men about gender-based violence, you need to educate them on why they should care about it and stop doing it. Thank you for listening to Witch Hunt.
Keep the conversation going in your sphere until you join us next week.
Have a great today and a beautiful tomorrow.